Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is reported to have said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Religious scholar James Carse argues that the correct statement is, "What will set you free is not truth, but truthfulness." Elizabeth Strout won the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction.
I believe in literature the way some people believe in their religion. And I think that the literature, you know, to write a story is to stimulate the imagination. I mean, what are we without our imaginations? How can we feel compassion? How can we feel empathy? How can we be civilized if we are not having our imaginations stimulated, being asked to work? And we become dogmatic idiots. And we don't want that. We're better than that.
Dogmatism always gets us in trouble.
Always.
Including within literature. But I can't think offhand, if it's great literature, I can't think of anything that I would call dogmatic.
Not if it's what I think of as the real stuff. It's always, you know, as similar as we are, we're different enough that those differences are vast and
isn't
awe-inspiring, really.
Openness absolutely essential to the concept of great literature?
I think so. You can't be careful. Or you're going to write something that isn't worth somebody's time. That's what I believe.
Growing up in Maine, Elizabeth Strout connected with these small private stories that compose an individual life. She's built that understanding into an outstanding career as a novelist. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Olive Kitteridge, joins earlier success with Amy and Isabel and Abide With Me. Ms. Strout's short stories have been published in The New Yorker and other prestigious magazines. My pleasure at reading her books was matched by the chance to explore them with their author. Elizabeth Strout, once upon a time, as all good stories begin, I fell in love with a small group of people in a very isolated place, and I wanted to go back to them, and I would occasionally over the years. But until you came along, I sort of felt bereft. Now, those people lived in Sarah Orne Jewett's book, A Country of the Pointed Fur. And as I was reading Olive Kitteridge, as I was reading Amy and Isabel, as I was taking a peek at Abide With Me, I had the feeling that you fell in love with them too somewhere along the line.
Many, many years ago, yeah. And
we forget,
yes,
that heritage is strong and beautiful.
Exactly.
So I'm not wrong?
No, I don't. I mean, I would not say that was wrong at all. Not at all. I think that place is so much a part of storytelling, and what happens to a character in a place at a certain time.
And yet each of those people, even when you do put them in New York,
yeah, that's right,
are the same people, mm-hmm, different,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I found The Country of the Pointed Fur through literature. I found it just because I came across this wonderful book. But that's not your experience, I think.
No, I believe, if I remember correctly, and I probably don't, but I do believe that my mother gave that to me many years ago. I think. Might have been an English teacher, but I think my mother probably gave that to me.
And what inspired her?
Well, my mother always wanted to be a writer, and my mother loves literature, and my mother is also a fabulous storyteller. So all those things connected. She was always handing me the right book at the right time.
Did she write now?
She did some writing back when I was younger, but I think that she's not been writing for many years. But she taught writing in school.
She taught it, but didn't do it.
She did it many years ago, but
I find that interesting because,
right,
I mean, everybody in the world, everybody says,
right,
"Oh, I have a novel in me," or,
that's,
"Oh,
right,
I'm a writer."
That's right.
But not everybody does it.
That's right. Well, she was very, very interested in the creative mind. She was interested in literature. She was interested in the act of writing. And she taught high school English, and she finally convinced the school to have the entire sophomore year devoted simply to writing. And a lot of it was expository writing. It wasn't like she was necessarily writing, running a fiction workshop, but she was just really interested in how people put an honest sentence down on paper.
What happened to that? Where did we lose track of that in American education?
Yes, one might well ask. I don't know. But
if you think about the, shall we say, dreck that shows up in what is thought of as writing.
Yeah.
So is your mother still with us?
She is.
And does she smile every time she opens the New Yorker and finds her daughter in the New Yorker?
I think she's my greatest fan. I have to tell you, I think she's tremendously supportive. She's wonderful.
Does she ever critique? Yeah.
She doesn't. And I appreciate that. Yeah. I don't show her anything until it's done, and then she always reads it twice, very quickly and thoroughly through, and then she'll always tell me that it's better than the last one.
Yay, Mom!
Yeah, really.
Well, yay, writer, because you've probably learned something from...
I totally learned so much from her.
What a great pleasure it is to be with Elizabeth Strout. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Paula Gordon. We hope you'll be with us. Welcome back. I'm Paula. Elizabeth Strout is a wonderful writer. I sat down thinking, well, I read a lot of this heavy nonfiction stuff, but you absolutely captivated me in the ways that you brought the universality and the particularity, if I can say it that way.
Yeah.
You don't miss the opportunity to say, oh, look at what those terrible people in Washington have done to this country, and yet it's never didactic. It's never teachy-preachy. How does one find that kind of a, forgive my saying, voice?
Well, I'm interested, you know, I'm just so interested in people, in character, in the hidden self, and the way, in particularly, all of it's not quite so hidden, I guess, but I'm just so fascinated with how people manage to get through life. And personality and character and what I just love stories about people. So I just and
yeah,
then
but you like plants too. You're very fond of tulips.
I love the physical world. That's true. I love the physical world.
And over
very
and
much.
Over again, in many ways, without ever saying it, you put us back into nature, we are a part. Is that intentional?
I think it's just an act of love on my part. I think that when I go to the page, I love those raspberries that are growing wild, and I love the bridal wreath that's growing wild about the window because I see it and it takes me back. I grew up in Maine. It takes me back to the smells of the pine needles. That's part of the world of these people. It's our world, so...
You live in New York.
I've lived in New York now for 25 years, but I grew up in Maine, and I came from one side of my family came from 10 generations, the other side came from 12 generations. That's a lot, if you do the math. That's a lot of generations of Maine. And so that's...
What is that, the beginning of the colonial period?
1603 or something, before, you know, like, I think, white, you know, way back.
Way early.
Way back.
Yeah.
So
you're a real maniac.
Yeah. I
had to say it. I'm
sorry. Hardcore real thing. You know?
I remember, it's been decades now. I remember when early public broadcasting had a comedian, and the whole series was called Down East, I think. And it was my first understanding of regional humor. Maybe some teacher had said, well, there is this thing. The difference from one part of the country.
So different. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating. And I feel a couple of things about that. One, I feel that I'm writing about a section of the world that's disappearing because the whole country's changing and it's time for it to change and all that kind of stuff. But there's this section of American history that I feel like I'm sort of recording right before it kind of gets evolves into the next stage. And also, flying around the country on the different book tours, I have to say it's been fascinating to see. This is a huge country, and it's so different in all its regions. And to go places that you wouldn't necessarily go as a tourist, it's just astonishing to me. It's just fascinating.
Don't you sometimes wonder how could we possibly be one country?
I do. I wonder that a lot.
Or when will it break?
Yeah, exactly. I do, especially more and more. I wonder that.
Well, in a way, you're following the tradition of Sarah Orne Jewett, because what she did, that's J-E-W-E-T-T, Sarah without an H. I'm not sure anybody reads her. And yet, she had done exactly what you did in mm-hmm. another period. And mm-hmm. her, it's part of a whole series of stories.
Right.
So you're in a tradition not only of 16 generations back,
right.
but also a literary tradition.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
We did a program in very recent past with Hermione Lee, who has given us the great gift of not only cleverly, beautifully giving us access to Virginia Woolf, yeah. but now really resurrecting in a serious way Edith Wharton.
Yes.
And I was thinking about Wharton and Jewett in more, and Willa Cather, because she's done work with
yeah.
Willa Cather, who
yeah.
I've not
yeah.
read very much in a long time. None of this feels like it's being women's history. This all feels really natural.
Yeah, exactly. And Edith Wharton, she's amazing. She's just amazing. And I reread her and I think about her. And she has those two small novels, Summer, which is somehow not as well known as it should be, I feel, and then of course Ethan Frome, and they, those two New England-based small novels are just pearls, and of course her other work is wonderful as she reflects the New York
society. She wrote 43 books.
Yeah,
who knew?
Yeah, exactly. But she just got right down to it.
And she told the truth,
way.
And
exactly.
it seems to me that that's one of those things that
exactly.
you do really consciously.
Yeah,
as well as
I do.
Unconsciously.
I hope I do. I hope I do, because I that's what I want to be doing, because I just feel so strongly about this. I think that if you go and read a book that is cheap in its emotions or sentimental or somehow cutting corners, then you're doing a disservice to yourself and to your understanding of other people, and that we have to, I keep trying to hold on to the belief that we have to go to literature for the deepest, truest emotions. Otherwise, we do not know who we are, and we cannot understand what it's like to be another person. And we have to.
Well, if we don't know ourselves, how could we possibly know anybody else?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the more false sentences we utter, or the more false sentences that are uttered to us, the further away we get from knowing what we really feel.
I am often taken when I see one of those pictures of the mass of humanity, lunchtime on Madison Avenue or something, that is a picture frame just filled with bodies, or
That's
in
right.
Tokyo or in Singapore, when the whole frame is just these little bobbing heads and it's all people. It's very easy to forget that every one of those is a whole package of stories.
Exactly, exactly. Fascinating.
Overwhelming.
Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming. But it's pretty amazing.
I sometimes have sat in airplanes and have thought, Paula, don't think about it. There are 250 people on this plane. If you start thinking about every single person's stories, you'll go crazy. You have to get off this plane too.
right. Well, you know, it's a double thing. It's like in some ways you can get kind of overwhelmed with a sense of, well, almost the futility of having a story, you know, your own story, because there are so many. I mean, there are millions, billions.
6 billion
yes,
at the moment.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
that's just at the moment.
That's right. That's just at the moment. And so, you know, and they get born and die every 2 seconds or less. And so you can sort of feel a little overwhelmed with, like, well, okay, what's the point of even trying to capture one? And yet at the same time, I guess for me it is ultimately much more exciting than depressing, because it's just moving to me. It's just moving that everybody has their story.
Well, you also have wisely put them in constrained spaces so that they aren't they may be overwhelmed by the Republican Party, but they're not overwhelmed enough that we don't do a lot of suicide in these books. We talk about
right,
it,
right?
But these people do.
They endure.
Endure, exactly.
They endure.
Faulkner taught us.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I remember my mother reading that section of Faulkner to me, that his speech where he's, you know, man will endure. And
That was his Nobel Prize
yes,
speech.
Yes, that's
and
right.
The echo is his character Darcy.
Yes.
Who, and Bell regularly says, the point is not to endure, it's to prevail. Well, let's just start with enduring.
Enduring is pretty big, I think. I think it's pretty moving.
Is it the small townness that helps you with that, or is that simply the venue that...
I think for the moment, for the last three book moments,
right.
The small town venue has been natural to me because it is what I came from. It is what is somehow very familiar in some deep sense to me. What I'm working on at the moment, which I'm not going to go into too much, but it does start to include New York City, and I think it's just a matter of time before one can, you know, catch up to the different environments that one brings to the page. But the small town life has served me well in the sense that it gives me a chance to focus on how we do respond to one another up close and in a need, you know.
Well, the internal conversations, the internal growth and development seem at least as interesting to you and certainly to me as the reader as the external. It's
yes.
almost as if we have a
yes.
symphony going here
yeah.
and you've got codas and double and back and little
well,
minuet,
you know,
over there.
right, because that's how I say, and I was quite young when I, you know, had that sort of moment of realizing, oh, all these people, you know, you can state their facts, you know, here's so-and-so, he's a professor, he's a doctor, he's a lawyer, he's a fisherman or whatever, but then inside, what do they think about in the middle of the night if they can't sleep? Do they sleep? If they don't sleep, why aren't they sleeping? And I just, from such a young age, found that so interesting that we walk around with these, you know, external facts that can sort of describe us, and then we have all this internal gobbledygook.
Or lie about us.
Exactly. And how do we maneuver some sense of equilibrium?
We're going to be back in a moment and explore that equilibrium a little further. It is a pleasure, in a way, to be with Olive Kitteridge, as well as her creator and the author, Elizabeth Strout. Be with us when we return in just a moment. I'm Paula Gordon. Ms. Strout and I invite you to be with us when we come back. Elizabeth Strout is in conversation with me. I am Paula Gordon, and we're glad that you're with us as well. Ms. Strout, I've never asked anybody this, so tell me if it's none of my business, but I find in my own dream life that it's taking me a long time to catch up with the current time and place in which I live. I am dreaming a little less about my childhood. I've begun to be able to place my dreams in the place I lived 15 years ago, but I haven't quite caught up, 20 years ago, I haven't caught up to get my dreams placed here. That lag time seems to be part of what you're talking about
yes,
in being ready.
I think it is, and I've noticed that. I mean, I've been writing all my life, but I, in my sort of more adult years, I recognized that there was sort of a lag time of about 15 years, that whatever I had experienced or perceived as something true, you know, it seemed to take about 15 years before it could make its way in some form to the page. That has actually sped up. Now, whether that's just the process of aging and some sort of intuitive sense that time is, you know,
well,
gets
you're building on strength at
and
that
building,
point.
Right, that's true. So that I have noticed that it doesn't take as long for something to show up in my work in a certain kind of emotional way. So
maybe my dreams will catch up.
I think well, maybe they will.
Do your dreams interact with your awake in these things?
I feel that I dream during the day all the time. You know, I used to. My college roommate used to say, Elizabeth, stop, you're spooking me out, because I would be just staring at the wall. You know, so I've just been a person who sits and stares very easily. My nighttime dreams are different. They sort of are all over the place, and I don't see them so much connected to the literary work that I do. But certainly, I guess I'm what they call spacey.
Well, you create spaces.
Very easily, I space out.
But one needs that kind of magic to go into a new place, to create a new place.
Yep.
Do you start with the place? You're so keenly...
I tend to start with I think it changes. I think that I can start with the image of somebody doing something. I can start with a sentence that I hear somebody say. Or sometimes I remember one of those stories in Olive came from an image. I was sitting on the subway in New York, and this darling young woman was sitting on her boyfriend's lap, and she just was so darling and so young, and so when I sat down a few years later, I became Harmon, who sees this young couple while she sits on her boyfriend's lap. And of course then the story took off and it wasn't everything that it seemed, but certainly
but is
in
it
that
ever?
Case, no, exactly. That's why it's so fun to be a writer.
And you have some control over that, unlike being alive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Does that help one have a sense of control to be able to be?
Somebody had once suggested that to me many years ago, and I was like, oh, no, you know, I'm done. But I think I didn't really realize. Yeah, I think that probably there is some desire to control, you know, the randomness or the apparent randomness of what we're all kind of bouncing around doing here to make some sense of it.
Sort of like, now you're trying to tell me, as does your publicist, that Olive Kitteridge is a series of short stories. No, it's not.
No, it's not.
No, yeah, it's
exactly.
not. Who
exactly.
are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding anybody. That's it. Exactly.
And as I read it, I kept thinking of the great tradition, whether you're talking about Durrell with his Alexandria Quartet, or Rashomon with all of these sides, which I think becomes Seven Samurai or something mm-hmm, in the mm-hmm, movies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That tradition that says right. you look at the diamond, or the ancient tradition of what is the elephant? Well, you ask the guy who felt the tail, or the trunk, or the whatever.
Exactly.
And you get a different animal
exactly,
each time.
Exactly.
Isn't that what this is about?
That's totally what Olive is. And, you know, there. And I love point of view. I love the fact that, or I'm fascinated by the fact that we only get to see life from our own point of view is so frustrating.
How
to
boring!
Me. I can't stand that. And I think that's part of the reason I'm a writer, because I so desperately want to know what it feels like to be another person. And, you know, I'm never going to know. So I have to, you know, make it up. But I want to know. But I'm also fascinated by, here's Olive Kitteridge, and, you know, from a sort of frontal, you know, head-on, she's kind of powerful in this particular way. But then you slip in and see her sideways, or you see her from the back, and there's so many aspects to her. And I think that's true with all of us, but she's particularly a force.
Do you have a model for her?
She's a compilation, you
yeah.
know, all most people that I write from are different pieces yeah. of people I've known, or characters, or parts of myself, frankly, because it is only my own eyes that I'm going to see most of the world through. So
it's interesting to hear you say that, because I sort of am the flip side of that. I'm the complement, or the supplement you pick. I have always longed to have all of those lives so that I could live 11 lives. So I read voraciously.
Yes.
And I think it's the same thing you're talking about.
I think it is, too.
So because rather than what you're doing, which is inventing the same things, I've read thousands, I don't think I'm exaggerating, thousands of novels in addition to the nonfiction stuff, which in a way does the same thing differently.
Exactly. And it's the same kind of joy when you first, you know, as a young person, you know, you first read that piece of fiction, you go, oh, I had that thought. But you're so young that it's still exciting, and that's...
And you thought you were the only one.
And you thought you were the only one, exactly, and then...
So is there anything new under the sun?
Probably not, but people don't know that, because there's always somebody, you know, we're so quick to feel shame, and when you think about it, most of our shame is just from being human.
I once said to Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who to me is one of the most extraordinary storytellers, because she has these extraordinary stories coming out of being the first family, white family, to live among the Bushmen in the Kalahari in the 1950s. I once suggested to her that shame was perhaps our first tool, and more or less stopped her in tracks, because she said, This is very big, what you're saying.
Yeah, that is big. That's interesting.
And the toolness of shame within the social animal confines, if you will, of being human. It's really huge.
Yes, it is huge. I think it's huge. I think it's really huge.
And you find it in 1,000 different facets of each of your stories.
Right, right. It's, I always think, you know, I'm a great fan of John Cheever and his journals. I just absolutely adore. And he has this recurring image in his journals of a naked prisoner crouched in a cell trying to dig his way out with a spoon. And for all he knows, the door may be open. And there's something that about that image that's so compelling to me. And you know.
Yeah. I'm going to have us go away for just a moment. After I correct myself, Faulkner apparently said to prevail, to both endure and prevail, he apparently said that in the Nobel acceptance speech. So forgive me that. And it is Dilsey, not Darcy. So having corrected Paula on her Southern and universal literature, we'll be back in just a moment with Elizabeth Strout, Olive Kittredge, and a number of other interesting people, including Amy and Isabel, when we return in just a moment. Oh, I'm Paula Gordon. What a pleasure to be with Elizabeth Strout.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
How does it be to be able to write for The New Yorker and for Oh, the Oprah magazine? To me, that is, there's something magical about that.
Well, you know, a story is a story. And
is a story,
yeah.
Says a rose is a rose is a rose, Gertrude Stein.
Right. Exactly, which is something I sometimes think about. A story is a story, and it can speak to, hopefully can speak to many, many people. And there aren't, unfortunately, that many venues left for short stories right now, which is, I think, very sad, because people need them. I believe people need them. So if you pick up O Magazine or you pick up The New Yorker and you can read something where you just feel that little bit of sense of understanding about something that happened to you or something that happened to somebody, just whatever it is that we look for of like, oh yeah, right.
How many words does it take to do a short story? I really ask that as a technical question.
I never understood the whole word thing because I don't do math well enough. But I think a short story is typically around 10 pages, but mine are usually longer.
Well, I ask that because you would think that, I mean, if you could, for instance, tell a short story almost like a haiku in, say, 1,200 words, which is really, 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 really hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could probably get in a USA Today or someplace that has, I mean, we could create a genre. Because clearly, with the explosion of book clubs and poetry readings and things, people want it.
Yeah.
And at some point, people are going to have to demand it to get it.
Right, right.
My question, so then, is a technical one. When I'm writing things, I'm usually at 500 or 600 words. It drives me crazy. But there's a discipline to the shortness. And perhaps we could...
right.
There, or do a praise for the short story, for the book.
And there is, what they call short shorts, and that's sort of a genre. And I think I'm too much of a blabbermouth to be able to get it much shorter myself. But I think it's great when people can, and it may be that will become even more available.
I had not thought about short shorts, but that probably is something one could do.
Right.
But boy, would that be
pages.
Hard.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried it?
No.
I just think it would be immensely difficult.
I haven't. Because I find myself stretching out, you know, too much into the...
Well, without those
the
details...
The slant of sun.
Well, it wouldn't be you, would it?
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so. Although, never say never. We don't know.
Indeed.
It doesn't look it, though.
When I think about all the people I know, half of them are out of books.
What do you mean out of books?
I mean people who have never existed outside the mind of the writer.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, well, that's wonderful.
Well, that makes a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
if we evolved, as the anthropologists tell us, to live in groups of maybe 8 or 12, and the most people you'd see in your life was 100, what do you do with thousands of people in your brain?
Well, I guess you wait for some of them to come forward and some of them to move back, and then someone else takes a little turn on the stage. And
you have people doing so many different things. How do you, when I think about somebody writing a book, how do you know that many things? Are you a reader as well as a writer?
You know, it's interesting. Oh, I'm a voracious reader. I read all the time. If I'm not writing, I'm reading, and I feel like I'm doing my work. It's a wonderful way to not feel guilty, because then I'm reading. I think I'm doing my job.
What do you read?
Oh, I read. I very often go back to the classics and reread. You know, like I'll reread Edith Wharton and Virginia Woolf and Middlemarch and Tolstoy, and I'm always rereading, because every time I read it, it's a different book to me, and I think, you know, where was I the last time I read this a few years ago? Because now it's all, you know, it's different. But
and were in a different place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm always, you know, telling my students, read a book again in a few years. You won't even know you read it, because you're different somehow.
And
it's a different story.
Isn't that what education is also about, to give you that first time so you got it done?
That's right, because if you're not exposed to it, then how do you know? You know, it took me, I think, 4 different classes of T.S. Eliot before I finally said, oh, my God. You know, and then
I'm still number 2.
Yeah.
Well, to be able to get access to people who clearly are onto some big magic takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
And in America, we don't like that part.
No, I don't think so. But certainly poetry has helped. I mean, I did in college, I think it was my mother exposed me to a lot of American literature, but college exposed me to a lot of poetry. And I loved that poetry, you know, Tennyson, you know, all the older poets and also some of the more contemporary ones. And I have, I belong to the Poetry Society or whatever, so, you know, whatever it is, so that poetry is constantly coming into my apartment. And that's very, very important to me, because I've often thought that poets have an access to something that's really pretty magical.
And you tell me that John Berryman, in just one line, it's just elegant. John Berryman, well, I didn't know who John Berryman was. Whoa, who's John Berryman? Ooh. The ability to plant little things in my head must make you feel sort of like a goddess.
Oh, I wish. I wish. Mostly mostly the work of a writer is a very solitary, strange kind of existence. That particular story that you're referring to with Berryman's line, you know, I wanted to get that right. I'm absolutely compulsive about making sure that I can get as close to the bone for the truth of a story. And I went to the library and I read everything I could about that particular condition that's in that story in Coming Tide, and used every aspect of my own emotional experience to try and push it to the extreme, to get to the point where I could write about Kevin Coulson.
And yet you always give me enough, but you leave room for me many, many places to fill it in.
Yeah.
It's just remarkable how I'm certain I know what you're saying, whether it's true or not.
Well,
I have a certainty that and whether it's true or not doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't, because it's your book.
Yeah.
Once I write it and I give it to the reader, I'm very big on a relationship with the reader. I write for a reader who will need it, understand it, on whatever level they understand it. That's their, you know, everybody will come to a book bringing their own life's experiences, and they will see it in their own way, and they should. So my job is to give the reader something that's on some level true enough that they can respond to it with their own life's experiences.
I don't want to go too far from poetry before saying that our next-door neighbor is Thomas Lux, who is a wonderful poet.
Absolutely fabulous,
and has introduced me back into poetry. And his ability to go someplace that I think I've looked at and see something that never occurred to
me. Exactly.
is that poetic essence also to be found in any great writing?
I think so. I think that they're hopefully quite closely connected. Yeah, absolutely. Those glimpses, those visions, the completely or hopefully original way of rendering it, the use of language that can produce a completely different sense of something that seemed familiar and becomes familiar in a new way. And then there's just the plain old rhythm. You know, I love the way a sentence falls on the ear. And so much contemporary stuff I read, I'm appalled, frankly, that the writer doesn't seem to be understanding that the ear has to be addressed. You know, there's so many things that go into a piece of writing. There's the emotional truth. There's the story itself. Is it going to leave somebody feeling that they've been through an experience that was worthwhile? But then there's also the way it sounds to the ear.
Which takes me to music.
Yeah.
Isn't that sort of the third leg on the stool?
I think so. I think it should be. And I recently heard somebody say, oh, there's no point in writing a good sentence anymore because nobody cares. And, you know, that's pretty depressing. And maybe it's true. I can't believe it's true.
And besides,
if it is, I don't want to think about it.
Well,
because I believe the way a sentence sounds is connect. There's style is substance.
Mm.
And I believe that. Mm-hmm. And the way a sentence sounds and the density or the muscularity of a sentence is going to be connected to the heft of the story or the...
The philosopher Frederick Furet talks about the need for a sense of beauty, a sense of feeling. He first uses the word emotion. Then he says, no, let's talk about feeling. It has more muscularity.
Mm-hmm.
That denseness matters, too, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It absolutely does. And when I, you know, I'll read stories or something, or it'll come across my, some subject that's very, you know, serious. I mean, humans, our lives are serious. I don't mean they're not hysterically funny. They are. But this is serious stuff we're all trying to do here. And so when I see sentences that are just, like, sort of spun off without a care, then... It's directly affecting the experience of the emotional impact of that story, the gravitas, the resonance that one is hoping to strike.
And we see that in television.
Yes,
and we see
exactly.
that in most
All the
of
time.
In the junk radio.
Junk. It's
and
like eating.
You are what you eat.
Exactly. That's right. And we're just all shoving more and more Twinkies in our mouths, and it's...
No Twinkies here. We'll be back in just a moment with the real deal. This is Elizabeth Strout. I'm Paula Gordon. Be with us when we return. No. Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon. Elizabeth Strout has joined me. Thank you so much
it's
for
great
that.
Great to be here.
Daniel Levitin has written about the... In fact, he has a wonderful book called The Brain on Music. And he talks about the physicality of these experiences. And in a very real sense, it seems to me, whether you're talking about instrumental music or singing or the baby listening to mama's heartbeat,
mm-hmm.
excuse me, microphone, whether you're talking about listening to how poetry works in the brain or the cello or that sentence,
this is
all the same part of the importance of the aesthetic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. I mean, when you say cello, is there anything as gorgeous as a cello?
The answer is no.
I don't think so. For me, boy. And how can one tell a story that has that sense of dignity? Is that an old-fashioned word? Maybe it is. But,
so what's wrong with old-fashioned?
What's wrong with trying to bring some sense of resonance and dignity and deep sound to what our stories are?
We have the great good fortune to have a beloved best friend in Janos Starker, who is the world's preeminent cellist. He's sort of the dean of cellists. And he both teaches it as well as just being an awesome performer. So he practices what he preaches. And so many, many years ago when I first met him, I said, can you take what you do and put it into words? He said, well, of course not, and now I'll try. And his condensation, if you will, of what makes it great is balance, purity, and simplicity. Mm-hmm. Balance, purity, simplicity. Mm-hmm. And then 30 years later, I asked him again. He said, yeah, balance, purity, simplicity. And now I add one more, and that is discipline.
Yeah.
And it would seem to me that discipline, in addition to balance, purity, and simplicity, is a lot of what your writing is about.
I like that, the balance, simplicity, and purity, because I think that it's essential for a writer to make sure, when we talk about, you know, Hemingway's thing of, like, write the truest sentence, you know, what does that mean? It means a lot of things, but one of the things it means is don't show off. Mm-hmm. Don't you know, be pure, be simple, be direct, be as pure and simple as a child. And the business of showing off, or, you know, doing some pyrotechnics here or there, or look what I can do, and, you know, that's to me, that takes away from...
Well, and it doesn't endure, thank you for
that. No, I don't think so. I think you're exactly right.
Again, as a real guide in thinking about these things, Starker has said, I was complaining to him once about modern music, which I also can complain about some of modern poetry, the stuff that came between the 60s and the 90s, if you will. And I said, it's just ugly to me. I don't like it. It isn't pretty.
Right.
And he
right.
said, don't worry about it. In the end, the great stuff endures.
Right.
Well,
right.
I think it's part of
true.
Why I worry about the dreck of which you speak in writing is, I hope so,
yeah.
But what if it gets drowned out?
Well, that's the worry, is that is there so much foolishness and foolishness, that's what I think of it as. Is there so much of it, and is it's are we so becoming so accustomed to it that it just will, it's, you know, like a dust that's settling over the truer things that one would have hoped a number of years ago would endure. I don't know. There's no way of knowing. But one hopes that there's something in us that continues to reach for the pure and the simple and the honest.
I think a lot about politics, and it would be easy for me to say, oh, well, that's not what this is about. But everything that you're writing about is political in the deepest sense, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Well, isn't it Virginia Woolf who said the personal is political?
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure.
And vice versa. Well, yeah. She didn't. It should have been she. It would have been appropriate.
I heard it. You know, I've heard it attributed to other people, but I think that she said so.
It is regularly said that it is our artists who show us what's over the horizon.
Yes.
And it would seem to me that some of what you're saying in these wonderful books is that we have dissed the common person in ways that are simply inappropriate, and especially
right.
if one cares about democracy.
Right,
that
right.
these are the people who we need to be hearing from, who haven't lost track of what's important, who are not going to stab you in the back, except for those who will, and then what are we going to do about that?
Right.
And it seems to me that much of what you say can then be taken to the next place. And if one is writing or reading Dreck, it doesn't do
no,
that
for us. No, it doesn't do that. It doesn't do that. It's,
so is there
it's
a political
sort of topical and it will, you know, move away.
Is there a core, forgive my asking, political vision in this of and what we might be?
I think there has to be. I mean, look at, let's start with Amy and Isabel, which takes place, I purposely wasn't specific because I wanted a sort of an impressionistic kind of feeling for that. And then with Abide With Me, I got very specific in 1959, but there's Amy and Isabel, you know, a single mother raising a daughter, and she was ashamed of the fact that she had that child out of wedlock. Now, that's not our world anymore. So that was the record of something that was about to no longer become.
And a lot of people just don't remember that was just
they don't even remember
unacceptable.
That, but it was absolutely the way it was in that time and
some
place.
People did give their babies away and some people kept
that's
them.
That's right. And that's right. And that's sort of, that's the story of us, that'd be a different story in 2008. And Abide With Me specifically in 1959, yeah, you know, a whole different kind of ministry, which I, you know, I'm just not even going to get into that right now.
Oh, I bet you've had quite a ride with them.
Oh, dear Lord. but
as it were.
You know, so and then here's Olive, you know, going to visit her son who's accepting a certain kind of life in New York, and will the subway blow up, and what does this mean to Olive? And she's, you know, got to walk through security with her shoes off, and her vulnerability, and the parrot that's shrieking, praise God. You know, so yeah, this is some record, I hope and believe, of who we are and what's emerging and where we're going and how fearful we are.
And if we don't examine it, it owns
absolutely.
Us.
Of course. Absolutely.
I had a sense with Olive that you wanted her to liberate herself, that she had so much potential.
Yes.
And that her own constraints in her own powerfulness and in her own weakness were, I don't know if you remember the TV series called The Stranger, but it was in the 60s, early 70s, 14 episodes long, came out of England. Absolutely brilliant. It, I think, became a cult thing. But in the course of these 14 episodes, I don't remember the actor's name. He was the actor and the producer, but look it up, The Stranger.
I will. I'm not familiar with it.
And in these 14 episodes, the shtick is that this guy has become captured, and it turns out they filmed it in Port Marion in Wales. And it's elaborate, and it's fanciful, and it looks like science fiction, and in the end, that which has captured him is his own sense of self. And you go through, I mean, it's a masterful series. But inevitably, with all of these characters, don't we come back to our worst prison keeper?
Yes.
Is ourselves.
Which is why, you know, I think I'm so drawn to that image of Cheevers, you know, with the prisoner, the naked prisoner, and the, you know, the vulnerability of that prisoner. And yes, Olive is certainly a prisoner. She is a prisoner of herself. And she's also a prisoner of time and place. She's a very intelligent woman. And where, you know, does she have a venue for that kind of ferocious energy? Not exactly. And yet her own bafflement at what to do with all that energy. And
which makes her quite heroic.
Yes. Yes. I think so.
Joseph Campbell tells us that the hero is he or she. I will update him. He or she who goes out and has an adventure and then comes back and tells the community about the adventure. So without coming back, you're not heroic. You're
right.
Just you're reckless.
Right. You're just gone. That's it.
So what's the difference between reckless and heroic? Well, isn't that some of what you capture in thinking about these characters?
Yes, I hope so. That's certainly what I'm hoping to do. Yes. Yes.
So you read all the time, and you hang out with poets, and you live in a place that is very stimulating. Can one get that kind of stimulation? Because there are still a lot of folks who are in either intellectual or social ghettos, and I think of the suburbs comes to mind first and foremost.
Yeah.
You don't have to be in a poor place in a city to be in a ghetto. You may very well be in a rich suburb.
Right. God
everything
knows.
And you could be in church, speaking of God knows. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to create these prisons.
Mm-hmm.
Is this part of the agenda, is to say, you don't have to be there, you can, it's not easy.
Yeah, you could be anywhere and be in your own prison, absolutely. And as far as, I don't know if this is directly connected to that, but as far as like living in New York and writing in New York, the fact of the matter is some people say, well, how can you live there and write? You know, the fact of the matter is I have a very quiet life in New York. I'm not really running around that much doing literary things. I'm very interested in the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm interested in Amnesty International. I'm interested in volunteering at Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital. So the things that I do outside my writing life really don't have an awful lot to do with writing. So I have a very kind of, in some ways, a very private writing life. It's still very furtive. It's a solitary thing.
Well, people think New York is big and noisy. New York is a bunch of little villages.
Exactly.
And you can do with it what you will.
You can do with it what you will. And And I'm just happy to have people walking around and seeing darling girls on the subway that then can show up in a story.
And we're glad that you do that too.
Fake fur denim jacket.
We'll have a few more minutes with Elizabeth Strout when we return. Be with us. I'm Paula Gordon. Elizabeth Strout has done me the honor to be with me. We were in New York's village. The village.
Right.
Greenwich Village, some years ago, with James Carse, who has written exquisitely about a number of things, including his wonderful ideas of finite and infinite games, a vision of life as play and possibility. And I said to him, sort of in the same vein, that we had just come back from the big woods. We had been in the Rocky Mountains or the Sierras or someplace. And he said, if you think about it, the wilderness, whether it is the big trees or the big city, are the places things happen. It's not monoculture. It's juicy.
Right, right. Exactly.
It gives one grist for the mill,
if you will.
That's interesting,
because that, yeah, I can see that. I can see that, yep.
Can yes. one find that if you have, it was David Bowie who said that when he was a kid, the musician, that he would give anything to get out of the suburbs. And did just about anything to get out of the suburbs. Isn't that some of what great literature offers us, is in a time that would dumb us down if we let it,
yes.
and would make us all
yes.
little automatons if we let it, and would be ruled by a small group of people if we let
yeah.
them?
Yeah.
Isn't that part of what literature
That's
continues
what
to do?
I am hoping. That is certainly my desire, my wish, my propeller, you know, for going there. Yes, that's it. You know, I believe in literature the way some people believe in their religion.
Well, religion has turned into sort of a dirty word,
it
I'm
has.
Sorry to say.
It's
it doesn't
very
have
sad.
To be that ugly. It can be nurturant. It can be something about
yeah,
love each other and
yeah, it's a difficult place to go, and we don't have time for me to get started on all that, but
and it's but something it's, we must begin to question, America, because it's been shoved down our throats so dramatically.
And so dogmatically, with such lack of imagination.
Well, and meanness.
And meanness. And I think that the literature, you know, to write a story is to stimulate the imagination. I mean, what are we without our imaginations? How can we feel compassion? How can we feel empathy? How can we be civilized if we are not having our imaginations stimulated, being asked to work? And we become dogmatic idiots. And we don't want that. We're better than that.
Dogmatism always gets us in trouble.
Always.
Including within literature. But I can't think offhand, if it's great literature, I can't think of anything that I would call dogmatic.
Not if it's what I think of as the real stuff. It's always, you know, as similar as we are, we're different enough that those differences are vast and
isn't
awe-inspiring, really.
Openness absolutely essential to the concept of great literature?
I think so. You can't be careful. You can't be careful. Or you're going to write something that isn't worth somebody's time. That's what I believe.
Apparently, I misspoke and was talking about Patrick McGuinn's, close enough, The Prisoner, and said The Stranger, but that takes me to a very interesting place in and of itself, because Albert Camus was very important to me as a kid, and reading The Stranger, and I had just enough French to read The Stranger, which isn't very hard, and the whole notion of the existential moment, of living in the present, and, you know, use whatever fancy words you do mm-hmm. or do not like, again, that is what you bring me in all of these stories, is the chance to live in somebody else's present,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is a way of practicing compassion, isn't it?
I think so. I would hope so, frankly. Yes. Yes. You know, come inside for a few minutes and see the world this way.
The really great religionists, people like Jesus, who would suggest that we be thinking outside of ourselves, and of the great scholars, including Robert Funk, say he never said, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. What he said was love each other. Not as you love yourself, just love each other.
Right.
And being able to cut through the barnacles and to get back to these essential notions.
Right.
again, isn't that your work?
Yeah, and to love someone is to know them, or to know someone is to love them. I had a friend say the other day, she was watching people on a bus, and all of a sudden she thought, what if I was in love with all of them, and how they became so beautiful, and I loved it. I knew exactly what she meant.
Well, you've given us all kinds of people to be in love with, and now we're in love with you, and we will wait for more and more wonderful stories. We thank you so very much.
Go back to my solitary work. Thank you very much. It was lovely to be here.
A great pleasure. Bye.